afternoon, everybody. Welcome. Delighted to see you again. We have a slight change of tone today. We're not looking at any particular country. We're looking at a global problem, but one which I think is of interest to us all, particularly given some of the revelations we see from time to time to do with various influences being brought to bear on democratic practices across the world. Today we've got two experts on how to rig elections, and we thought this would be an interesting topic to explore today. And so I will introduce them both in a minute, and then they will divide up the time between them so they can make the presentation they want to make. Before I do that, just to say that next week in this room we have Sir Simon Gass, who is the political director of the Foreign Commonwealth Office, or was, sorry, from 2012 to 2016. And before that, he was British ambassador to Iran. And he's going to give a lecture entitled Iran and the West, Deal or No Deal. I think particularly at this moment in time, that is a very topical issue, and I hope you will attend. Any of you who like to attend, can you let Jacqueline know before, as soon as you can, or before you leave today? Also, can I thank you all very much for the support you give to GSF. Thank you in particular those who have joined GSF recently. Your support is very much appreciated. For those of you who wish to renew your subscription or haven't joined us yet, if you would like to, let Jacqueline know as you leave and she can give you the details of how that can be done. But today, as I say, our subject is how to rig an election. And there is a book you'll see at the back of the room, which is authored by our two guests today. And if you would like to buy one of those, I'm sure they'll sign that for you afterwards. But our two speakers today, firstly, Nick Cheeseman, who's a professor of democracy and international development at the University of Birmingham. He's written a number of books. I'm not going to go through them all because it would take me most of the time we've got available. But he is the author of Democracy in Africa, Successes, Failures, and the Struggle for Political Reform, which came out in 2015, and various others since. So he has a very close working knowledge of the subject we're dealing with today. On my left, we have Dr. Brian Klass, who focuses on global democracy, democratic transitions, political violence and volatility, and rigged elections. He's a former US campaign advisor and a frequent political analyst of US domestic and foreign policy in mainstream media outlets. And so we have two experts speaking to us today. As I said, I let them decide how they will approach this. I think one's going to start, and then the second one's coming, and the first one's coming back again. But I leave it up to you to take us forward from that.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone, for coming today. It's great to see you. I've been trying to write a book that might be of interest to other people, policymakers, politicians, for quite a while, and it seems that with a title, How to Rig an Election, I may have finally cracked it. We should say at the beginning that we are not the election riggers. This is an important distinction because in recent media interviews it has needed to be stressed. This does look like a handbook for rigging, and many of you could take it that way. The book will take you through six particular strategies of electoral manipulation that leaders around the world could use, what we call the dictator's toolbox. But the aim of the book, of course, is not that. The aim is that we think many of you in this room, certainly authoritarian leaders around the world, and many election observers, will know many of the stories that we have in the book. But at the minute, we're pretending that many of these elections are of an acceptable quality. We're pretending that the levels of electoral manipulation around the world are actually acceptable. And what we try and explode in the book is actually that myth. We talk about actually how systematic and how widespread manipulation is. And then we use that as a springboard to talk about what we can do about it. So the book begins with two different trends. The first trend is that more elections are being held than ever before. If you go back to the 1940s, you had something like 30 to 40 elections a year. Fast forward to the last 10 years, something like 70 to 80 elections are being held now every year. So more elections than ever before. And yet despite that increase, the last 10 years have seen a democratic decline. On almost any measure you wish to choose, global democracy has declined for 10 years in a row. And almost for every year in the last 15 years, Freedom House, the US think tank that measures these things, tells us that more countries have moved towards authoritarianism than have moved towards democracy. So we have two interesting trends that seem to contradict each other. more elections than ever before, which you might think would promote accountable and inclusive government, and yet more authoritarianism than we have seen 20 years ago. And the answer, of course, to these divergent trends is that more authoritarian leaders have worked out how to use elections for their own purposes, how to manipulate elections to stay in power. Now, just to give you some of the sort of headline figures before Brian comes in and gives you some great examples, it's really important to note that we're not talking about the odd election here, the odd election there. We're actually talking about quite significant levels. So, for example, and most of the figures we'll give you today are in graphs and books, graphs and tables that you'll find in the book itself. Over a third of all elections, so a third of all elections that are held in Latin America, Asia, post-Soviet Europe, and Africa, over a third see significant systematic state targeting of violence against the opposition. Over a third, and in some countries near to a half, in all of those regions, see significant electoral day irregularities, which could refer to preventing opposition supporters from getting to the polling station, ballot box stuffing, and so on. Two-thirds of elections in Africa and a third of elections in those other regions I just mentioned witness systematic vote buying around elections. Now, what's really striking about those figures is two things. One, if you add it up, we're actually talking about every other election in some of these regions seeing significant manipulation of one form or another. But two, there is no correlation between those figures and the number of elections that are being condemned by international observers. Now, I said to you a moment ago that we have more elections than ever before. It is also true that we have more elections being monitored than ever before. In fact, in many of the regions I've just talked about, something like 90% of elections are monitored. So the problem is not coverage. The problem is not that we don't have people on the ground watching. The problem is that these kinds of behaviours that are being recorded are not leading to election observation reports that condemn the quality of the elections. Now, there's, of course, two reasons for that. The first reason is perhaps in some ways the most obvious. In many cases, there are geostrategic considerations about countries' relationships that mean that evidence about electoral manipulation doesn't always translate into condemnation of the electoral process. You need to factor in lots of different things. Was the election an improvement? If it was, do you want to put the cat among the pigeons by saying it was rigged when actually you can see significant progress? If the country is a significant ally, when we're talking about the war on terror or geostrategic issues like resources, you perhaps don't want to jeopardise that by playing too heavily on the quality of the election itself. In the book, we focus on a slightly different angle. What we talk about in the book is the growing capacity of authoritarian leaders to rig elections in ways that are very hard to detect and therefore essentially have their cake and eat it. Hold elections and through elections legitimate themselves, at the same time rig the elections, but without the cost that you might expect in terms of a loss of legitimacy and a loss of international funding. And one of the things we really pitch in the book is that the nature of authoritarianism has changed over the last 10, 20 years. If we were talking 20 years ago and we were to say, what does the average authoritarian state in the world look like? It would have looked like a military regime or a one-party state. It would not have held elections and it would not necessarily have been considered to be a respectable state by Western liberal consensus standards. The average authoritarian regime today holds elections. It looks like a respectable state. It's a member of multiple international global bodies. It presents itself as a democracy, but it significantly and systematically manipulates elections back home to prevent change. And one of the outcomes of this is that in many parts of the world, we actually see elections that very rarely lead to opposition victories. The most obvious example is in sub-Saharan Africa, where my own research in the book that you kindly mentioned from 2015 revealed that opposition parties win less than 1 in 10 elections on the continent. So despite the reintroduction of multi-party elections, what we're really seeing is the reproduction of authoritarian rule rather than revolutionary pressures leading to opposition parties. Now, what are the 6 strategies that we talk about in the book? I'll outline them very quickly, then hand over to Brian to give some examples. One of the things we talk about in the book is a difference between non-strategic and strategic strategies. There are certain ways of rigging an election that are so obvious, so easy to detect, that actually most of the authoritarian leaders we've talked to, and we've tried to talk to quite a lot, tell us that they would only use them in desperation, right? Ballot box stuffing. Observers will detect that. They'll be on the ground. It's very hard to do that systematically without being caught. That's what you do when your other strategies don't work, right? If you're a clever leader, they say you start 4 or 5 years before the election. You start by using more invisible strategies. Gerrymandering will be something that's known to most of you in the room, fixing of constituent boundaries. But many of you will not know that electoral commissions in the countries that we're talking about typically send out more officials to register people in government areas than opposition areas, thereby fixing the voters' role in favour of the government rather than the opposition. If you do this, you can allow everybody to go and vote, because when they go and vote peacefully, you naturally win, therefore giving you a good quality election that can be rubber stamped by the international community. The other strategies that we look at in terms of our more long-term strategies is, of course, the use of divide and rule and the use of violence and repression. But again, most of the authoritarian leaders that we've talked to say this is a last resort. In fact, what you really want to do is an episode of violence that's so bad it sticks in the public memory, attacking opposition supporters, perhaps abuse of certain communities, and then don't do it, but around elections you do what in Zimbabwe they call shaking the matchbox. You don't need to burn someone's house down if you burnt it down 10 years ago and you stand outside it with a matchbox. The message gets across. But we also talk about much more modern tactics. One of the things you will have seen, and I don't know if you saw the recent Spectator front page which kindly carried our book, to talk about Cambridge Analytica and the use of big data, the manipulation of our personal data, but also the fact, and this is important, that an increasing number of elections in the types of countries we're talking about use election technology. They are digitized. Digitized in terms of registering voters and digitized in some cases in terms of casting votes. And that's problematic because in many of these cases we assume the technology will prevent electoral manipulation. But what we know in reality is that actually the people in charge of the technology is often the Electoral Commission. The Electoral Commission is often strongly influenced by the ruling party. And so we get a sense of transparency and technical capacity that is actually undermined by a hacking of the process via the back door. The other strategy, of course, which is very obvious and often there to see, is vote buying. And vote buying is one of those strategies that we see across almost all of our cases. It's one of the highest in terms of intensity in almost all of the countries that we look at, almost systematic. But it varies quite considerably. It's much higher in places like sub-Saharan Africa than it actually is in places like Asia and post-communist Europe. But most leaders tell us that they don't rely on vote buying to win an election. Buying a vote does not guarantee you a vote, they say. Buying a vote is what entitles you to have a conversation with the voter about who they will vote for. If you don't offer the bribe, you may be considered to be illegitimate. But it doesn't seal the deal. The bribe has to be backed up. How do you back the bribe up? You make sure that the voter feels you can actually scrutinise whether or not they delivered. How do you do that? You have to undermine the sanctity of the ballot box. So some of the really innovative strategies we see today is leaders attempting to persuade voters that actually they can tell how you voted. A great example of this in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe and ballot papers have serial numbers. You persuade the head of the village, the chief, to line up his people. He knows the order of the people. He puts them in age order. He puts them in name order. He walks them to the polling station. He tells the first person, I know what the first ballot number is. I know what order you are on the list. If I want to look at the ballot papers after they've been cast, I'll be able to know which ballot paper you put in the ballot box. So remember the deal that you did when you registered to vote and you got the food aid in return. Remember the pact. We're going to check afterwards. So we actually now see elections in some parts of the world where people, worried that their loyalty and their willingness to keep the deal might be questioned, actually shout out who they would like to vote for. Elections in which head teachers pretend to be illiterate so they can pretend to need help from a security official so they can then tell the official very loudly who they would like to vote for so their voting intention isn't doubted and they can be seen to have confirmed the bargain. But here, and this is a really interesting point, we realise the way in which all of these different strategies are interrelated. The effectiveness of vote buying is only there because of the ability to break down the secrecy of the ballot and the threat of repression. And this is one of the key things that the book tries to bring out. It's the set of complementary strategies available in the toolbox that makes the toolbox so effective. Brian.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit more about examples of what we call strategic rigging, where there's a sweet spot of electoral rigging where it is both effective and difficult to detect, right? Which is the exact opposite of the very visible and ineffective forms like often vote buying can be if it's not enforced. So a couple quick examples. One is, and these you have to hand it to these authoritarians, they're sometimes very clever. In Ukraine, the opposition areas were regionally focused. So voters cast their ballots, everything went according to plan. They didn't realize that the pens that the regime had provided in the opposition areas had disappearing ink in them. And so 10 minutes after the ballot was cast, it appeared to be blank, right? Now again, this was legal because when you count the ballots, they appear blank. What are you supposed to do? But still illegitimate. In Madagascar, a place that I've done a lot of research, the president was quite open about explaining to me his strategy in 2006, where there is a legal requirement to register in person to become a candidate for president. His rival was in exile and had to return to Madagascar. So he took a plane from France, where he was in exile, and as the plane was about to land, the president picked up the phone and closed all the airports. He did that four more times until the deadline passed, at which point the courts declared the candidate ineligible. Again, legal, but not legitimate. Other times, the authoritarians try to be clever and botch it. So in Azerbaijan in 2013, there was an example where the regime said, we're going to be extremely transparent and develop an iPhone app in which you can see real-time results uploaded. What they mistakenly did was upload the results the day before the election. So anyone who had downloaded the app saw the results, and it was quite obvious what had happened. Now, these somewhat silly, but also, you know, they really do shine a window into the thinking of these people. We can think and laugh about how they seem to be in corrupt regimes abroad. One of the things that we also do in the book, and Nick will conclude with some thoughts about this too, is point the figure back at us and say, we do not have perfect elections. So one of the strategies Nick briefly mentioned was gerrymandering. And in the United States, it's a real problem where politicians are effectively picking voters in a significant number of states, where they're able to draw their own districts. You have such widespread gerrymandering, that in 2016, out of the 435 House districts, the average margin of victory in the United States was 37.1%. And you think about what that does, it depresses voter turnout because people think their vote doesn't count. And it also encourages polarization and extremism because you can only lose a primary but not a general election, right? It distorts the political system considerably, and it's a real toxin on the integrity of democracy in America. But we also have problems with voter suppression in the United States, where there are high barriers to voting in ways that often act like a poll tax in the modern era. This was much more formal during the Jim Crow era when there was literacy tests in the American South. But in some places, you have to buy a driver's license in order to vote. And that is something that if you don't have a car, you can understand who this disproportionately affects, people who are poor and generally minorities. So there's a cynicism behind that type of vote rigging. Now, these strategic aims are also being complemented by new types of rigging that we call the digital frontier. And this is where you use information flows and hacking to manipulate elections. So obviously, there are the high-profile cases of Cambridge Analytica that we have all heard about. But one of the points that Nick and I make is that this is the tip of the iceberg, both in terms of companies or entities that are working in this sort of shadowy world of election manipulation by manipulating information flows, but also because now there's a blueprint for a decentralized group of hackers or any sort of freelancers who want to wreak chaos and havoc on elections to be able to mimic the same strategies. They can be done from anywhere in the world, so unlike with ballot box stuffing where you need a henchman in the precinct, this is a much more decentralized and much more distant style of election manipulation. You also have in the United States digital election machines in many states that have no paper trail whatsoever. And researchers from the University of Michigan, trying to get the attention of the government to this problem, hacked into some machines and made it so that they would play the University of Michigan fight song every time that somebody cast a ballot. It certainly worked and got the attention of the US government, but those machines are still in operation in many states. And that's why one of the things that we worry about is that this will get worse before it gets better. And that there's a real risk that at some point in the near future, there will be an election in which it is demonstrably shown that votes were changed through digital means. Or that registration, voter registration databases were purged on some sort of partisan or ethnic or demographic line in a way that would completely undermine confidence in democratic institutions in the Western world. So we have a serious problem ahead of us. There are smart authoritarians that are doing these things, but we also cannot imagine that this problem is far away from us. And that's where I'll turn things back over to Nick to end on a more optimistic note of how we can stop thinking about rigging elections and save democracy instead.
Easy task. So let's start with a very quick recap. We have more elections than ever before, but we have a decline in democracy over the last 10 years. One of the reasons is that clever authoritarian leaders have figured out that the introduction of elections doesn't have to be the end of their time in office. They manipulate elections very skillfully. They often do so with the complicity of international partners, but at times they also do so in a clever way that makes it very difficult to detect what is going on. And we have both worked, Brian has been an election observer in Madagascar, I have worked with election observers across Africa. We know that they are good people doing a very tough job in difficult circumstances. And part of the reason for writing the book is to try and strengthen them and help them do their role better. What is the outlook for this? The outlook is actually pretty bleak. One of the things that we've been interested in when we talk to people across the world about election rigging is that authoritarian governments do look for what is happening in Washington and London and Beijing. They look for the international signals about what might be acceptable, what might I have to do in 4 or 5 years' time to continue my system economically and politically. And the signals around the world right now are not that you need to hold a fantastic election. We have a rising authoritarian powers, China, Russia, but in many parts of the world, we're talking also Saudi Arabia, Iran, and so on, that have little interest in promoting democracy abroad because they don't have democracy at home. But we also in the United States have a leader who is avowedly putting America first and has explicitly stated that he doesn't want his regime to place a great emphasis on democracy promotion. And many of you will have seen the recent discussion about the demotion of democracy promotion within the mission statement of the State Department in the United States. So the signals around the world do not suggest that international authoritarian leaders will need to respond in terms of holding better quality elections in the near term. What can we all do then as a proactive way of trying to fight back? One of the things that's really important is that most of the election observation teams that we've worked with are relatively good, understand what's happening, much better than they used to be at bringing in long-term experts and putting people on the ground early because they've heard the message about the strategic rigging which happens well before election day. So we no longer see election observers that turn up the day before the election and leave the day after the election. That's not true of the EU or the Carter Center anymore. But it is still true that we send relatively small teams and we spend a lot of focus on putting people in polling stations on election day. If the rigging is being done strategically well ahead of time, or potentially through hacking or manipulating data, what they really need is high-quality IT and data experts who can actually conduct that kind of analysis. That's what the vast majority of election observation teams currently simply do not have. So if we want to keep up with authoritarian governments, we need to innovate in response to their innovations. Election observation has to be reformed. The second point, of course, and this is a tougher one, is that we have to match up when it comes to commitment. At the minute, UK governments, US governments, and many European governments are not always putting electoral quality first. There's two ways you can see this. The first is that we've had incidents, and many of them are listed in the book, where election observers clearly indicate that an election is problematic, but a president or prime minister will phone up and congratulate the leader of that country on their election the same day. That effectively undercuts the position of the observers. We also see, and we track this again in the book, many countries in which we see very good election recommendations coming out of the observers. Almost every election, the observers say the 7 things that need to be done. But the ambassadors on the ground very rarely pick that up as the political agenda for the next 4 years and make financial assistance conditional on meeting some of those. So what you find is that the same recommendations that were there in the 3 elections ago are there 2 elections ago, are there in the current election, and will be there again in the next election. There's a disconnect. But as Brian said, if we're going to play that role, if we're going to become more proactive, we need to do two things to legitimate that, to avoid the accusation of Western hypocrisy and neo-imperialism. The first, and Brian's already hinted at this, is to get our own act in order. So if we are operating in a country that sees high voter ID laws that marginalise certain communities, if we see really strangely distributed constituencies that have clearly been designed to create one-party zones and keep people in power, we're in a particularly weak position when it comes to legitimacy to go and talk about enforcing electoral standards around the world. The second part of this is that we have to recognise that increasingly the idea of the West versus the rest is losing us friends and losing us influence. Going to places like Africa and lecturing people on electoral quality is not the best way to do it. What do we need to do? Well, in the book, we talk about the possibility of much more effective strategies where we partner with local and domestic observation groups. There are some impressive movements in this direction. For example, in Southern Africa, the South African Development Community, SADC, has recently revamped its laws around election observation, specifically to allow it to do long-term observation and write more critical and engaged election reports. Now, it's going to be a very long time before SADC comes out and says that an election is not free and fair, because the political will in the region is probably not there to make such a controversial statement. But the movement of organisations like that towards doing a much more serious job of election observation is important, because the message that an election is not good quality and needs to be improved is going to be much more powerful if it's said by both the European Union and the Carter Centre and a SADC-type organisation that has local legitimacy, where it is African leaders talking to African leaders or Latin American leaders talking to Latin American leaders. So we need to smarten up, we need to catch up, we need to do a much better job of forming collaborations, and we also need to recognise that leaders who have innovated over the last 20, 30 years have left us behind when it comes to our capacity to detect electoral manipulation. So we've tried to give you today a little taster of, first of all, how you rig an election, and then how you might go about stopping it. Thank you very much.